May it please the Court. Good morning, Chief Justice Steele, Justice Holland, and Justice Ridgely. Robert Besty here on behalf of the appellees. I'm pleased to introduce my co-counsel, Robert Wallace, and Kevin Farrell here from Washington, D.C., from Wilson, Elser, Moskowitz, Edelman, and Dicker.
Welcome to the Court.
The Court has admitted both of them pro hoc vice, and with the Court's permission, I'd like to turn it over to Ms. Walsh for the introductions of the appellants. Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. Nellie Walsh from Young Conaway, Stargate, and Taylor on behalf of the appellants. Your Honors, it is my privilege to introduce my co-counsel, Max Kennerly, of the Beasley Law Firm in Philadelphia. Mr. Kennerly has been admitted pro hoc vice before this Court and will be presenting the argument today on behalf of the appellants.
Welcome to the Court.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.
May it please the Court. When the Superior Court ruled that the plaintiffs had assumed the risk of defendants' negligence when they traveled to Afghanistan, it relied on two facts in the complaint. First, that the plaintiffs knew of the dangerous location in which they were located in Afghanistan. And second, that the plaintiffs knew of an impending attack 24 hours prior to the attack happening. But the plaintiffs did not know either of these facts when they signed that employment agreement in Afghanistan. And that's part of the problem with the Superior Court's order. At this stage, all of the facts are assumed as true for the plaintiff and all reasonable inferences are made in their behalf. The Superior Court's order, however, when looking at this assumption of risk by the plaintiffs, made assumptions about the plaintiff's subjective mindset when they were signing that employment agreement back in 2004, and made assumptions about their knowledge of the circumstances in Afghanistan. I think one of the important things to point out here is when you read the Superior Court's opinion, it looks retroactively at what happened in Afghanistan. It looks back also with what we now know about Afghanistan. Just 1 month before plaintiff John Dooley signed his employment agreement, President Bush declared in the State of the Union that businesses are opening, healthcare centers are being established, and the boys and girls of Afghanistan are back at school. The plaintiffs were not military officers. They were not mercenaries. They were civilian police officers from the United States who had been recruited to train civilian police officers in Afghanistan. They would not have known the particular circumstance in Afghanistan where the defendants would have. They would not have known the types of protocols, and guidelines, and procedures that were in place in Afghanistan, and the defendants would have.
What is your claim or your basis for a duty on the part of the defendants to the plaintiffs in this case?
The defendants managed the situation in Afghanistan. The immediate employer of the plaintiffs is not a party to this action, but the defendants, which own that employer, were the ones who were actually controlling the situation there. And in the employment agreement, paragraph 17 of it references certain, let me get the actual language here, it references certain health, safety, and security regulations, directives, or procedures that the plaintiffs are supposed to follow while they're in Afghanistan. Those plaintiffs, when they signed the employment agreement, would have rightly understood that everyone who was working over there was also obligated to follow the health, safety, or security regulations, directives,
but
or protocols.
The defendants are not parties to this agreement, are they?
They're not. The defendants, their position is that the agreement references them as affiliates in the liability clause, but they're not specific parties to this agreement. On information and belief, the defendants were the ones who actually drafted this agreement and then gave it to their subsidiary, which I think can fairly be characterized as simply a tax haven.
Now, the Superior Court concluded that it didn't have to decide whether this was controlled by Delaware law or the law of Dubai because the result would be the same. Is that your view, or is that an issue that's important to your argument?
I don't think our argument is dependent upon that because we see both Delaware and Dubai law as in the same framework as the Superior Court. We think that both of them produce the same result here. So our arguments aren't dependent on that, although obviously if Your Honors reach a different conclusion on that, then we would be focused on the particulars of Delaware or Dubai law, whichever one governed there.
Well, help me understand why we care about whether Dubai law or Delaware law applies to an event that occurred in Afghanistan. Dubai or Delaware law to interpret the contract, but what's the situs of the negligence?
Well, Your Honor, that would be the plaintiff's position, which is both Delaware and Dubai follow the Lex Loci rule. They both look to the law of the location which the incident occurred. It was the defendant's.
Well, is the tort here that you allege where the incident occurred or where the decision was made that prevented the employees from instituting security precautions that they wanted to institute because of the intelligence warning that there might be a bombing? Was the negligence telling them they couldn't institute those procedures, or was the negligence the accident itself?
The negligence would have been at different forms. One of them would be overruling the plaintiffs and telling them they couldn't implement these security
procedures. Well, where was that decision made? In Afghanistan, in Washington, D.C., in San Diego? Where was that decision made?
That's part of the problem. I don't know. I believe it was made.
Well, is it a problem? Is it an issue?
In terms of ruling here, I think it's part of why the Superior Court was premature in dismissing this. That's another issue that simply needs more facts to be filled out when we look at which law should apply to that. It could have happened in Virginia. It could have happened in D.C., and it could have happened in Afghanistan.
Is it disputed? Just don't know?
We just don't know. We don't know specifically what occurred. Now, we've investigated it, but on the face of the complaint, it's not specific where it occurred because we don't know that. We allege negligence against the defendants, and so based on their own knowledge of it, they would be able to tell us where this decision was made.
Well, the defendants weren't in Afghanistan except by operation of law. They weren't. The decision maker denying the request to enhance security precautions was not made in Afghanistan.
That we don't know, which is they were in constant radio contact back and forth and satellite contact with Virginia. And so at this juncture, I don't know specifically where the decision was made. I personally, based on what we know, think the decision was ultimately made in Virginia. But at the same time, I can't say that definitively. I can't say what position defendants will take on that. I can't say who actually held responsibility for it.
For any choice of law analysis, is it important where the decision was made or the fact that the deaths occurred in Afghanistan?
I think both of those could be important. I think where the decision was made would probably govern here, but that's one of the problems with dismissal at this stage, which is defendants didn't produce an assumption of risk argument under Dubai law or under Afghani law. They simply argued under Delaware law. And at this moment, we don't even know which law would apply to this decision. So I would personally think it's the location in which the negligence occurred as opposed to the accident. But at the same time, partly because we don't have the facts to establish that one way or the other, that issue wasn't really developed by the parties. At this point, it's still simply at an allegation of the defendants we know through their control over the situation were negligent in the decision. But we don't know specifically where each one of these people involved in it was located, and we don't know specifically which one of them had, say, an advisory role and which was the actual supervisor and who thus controlled the decision.
Let me see if I understand your argument in the Superior Court's ruling. And the Superior Court seems to have held as a matter of law, once you agreed to work in this war zone, anything that happened was a risk you assumed and therefore no recovery. Your position is, while your clients agreed to work in the war zone, the risks they assumed were not necessarily all-encompassing, and that there's a material dispute of fact about whether they assumed these risks and that it should go forward and not be dismissed at this stage.
That would be correct. Our view is the plaintiffs assumed some risks. There's in the agreement it says dangers due to the nature of the mission. Our position is when a plaintiff looks at that and they look at the fact that they can be fired for endangering the safety and well-being of others, they will look at it as, I have assumed the risk that even if everyone does their job appropriately, I could be seriously injured or killed. That doesn't assume the risk that in the future the defendant could do some sort of negligent or tortious act and breach their duty and injure them. And I think that's one of the core problems with the ruling here, is that the Superior Court looked at it as a general release. But it's not a general release. That a general release refers to known claims. It's an exculpatory clause. And when you're drafting an exculpatory clause, and when you as the defendants know the situation, you know what risk, what legal risk you're trying to guard against, the duty is on you to spell that out of, here are the risks we are telling you about, you need to know about, that we're waiving here. One of these risks is we might breach our duties. That's nowhere in this employment agreement. It doesn't mention any wrongdoing by anyone.
Why wouldn't you read the employment agreement to create a situation or a legal relationship comparable to, you get a salary and you get workers' comp? That's what this language really means, that in exchange for the insurance that we're providing you for injury, for death, or disability, you are waiving claims against us and our affiliates directly, just like an employer-employee relationship with workers' comp. Why isn't that the logical way to read that paragraph?
Well, there's two ways to answer that. One is the practical answer of what the plaintiffs would have thought when they looked at it. It doesn't say workers' comp, and it doesn't say any wrongdoing by the defendant. Instead, it says everyone has a duty to follow particular security regulations and guidelines. The second answer for that is defendants themselves said the law of Dubai governs this contract. The law of Dubai does not have that type of workers' compensation system. That the defendants' experts didn't really address that at all, and the plaintiffs' experts specifically said that. It does not function like workers' compensation in the United States. You get guaranteed a certain benefit if you're injured, but you reserve your right to claim under tort and under malfeasance, as they refer to it there.
But the argument we see in the briefs is, you know, on the one hand, you can say you waived all rights, and the argument made by the other side is, no, you limited your compensation that you would get in the event of death to the insurance.
Well, that's the experts, at least in my view, the defendant's experts never actually adopted that explicitly. They simply talked around the issue, and plaintiff's experts specifically pointed out that's not permitted under Dubai law. Dubai law specifically says you can't limit it. And I think one of the important things to think about is in the civil code system, the defendant's attorneys came up with this limitation versus exculpation argument. Their experts didn't support that, and the UAE civil code doesn't support that. It says you can't waive these tort rights. And as plaintiff's
expert,
that's
why, in part, why I asked you whether it's important to you whether the law of Dubai or Delaware applies to this case. And you said, well, it doesn't really matter. But at least with respect to that argument, it seems to be significant, because at least based on what we see from the experts' affidavits as you're repeating it here, even if you've limited it under Dubai law, you have a right to ask for additional compensation. And that would not be the case in Delaware, would it?
It would not under statutory workers' compensation, which isn't here, but
any law, because what we have to decide is Dubai law and Delaware law synonymous for purposes of the legal issues in this appeal? And if not, which law applies? Is there a significant difference? So we've gone from you telling the court it doesn't really matter to saying, well, the contract is controlled by the law of Dubai. And if we apply the law of Dubai, it does matter, because even if they limited their recovery to insurance under the law of Dubai, they could ask for more money.
Well, let me clarify that. Chief Justice Steele raised, I think, the related issue there, which is the contract says it's governed and interpreted under Dubai law. So I think if we're interpreting the contract, it is Dubai law, and that's what applies here. That's, at least in my mind, that's separate from the substantive law of the tort and substantive doctrines like assumption of risk. So I would clarify to Your Honor that the contract is interpreted under Dubai law itself. The unfortunately fairly ethereal question is the difference between interpreting a contract for purposes of release and interpreting elements of substantive tort law such as assumption of risk. So I think when we're interpreting the contract of, you know, what did get release, and how does it function with this with these insurance benefits, we can look to Dubai law. But once we get to substantive tort claims, and for example, just to draw this distinction further, the injured plaintiffs, they signed this contract, and that's governed by Dubai law, the interpretation there. Their spouses, however, did not sign any contract saying due by law. So when you look at something like a wrongful death claim, that would be under Delaware law because there's no contract there that says due by law applies there. So,
well, why would that make a difference if the wrongful death statute in Delaware, in so many words, says it's a derivative claim? If the deceased had no claim, then it's not a wrongful act within the meaning of the wrongful death statute.
The Superior Court addressed this, and it was briefed a little bit more thoroughly in front of the Superior Court because they ruled in plaintiff's favor on that, which is the Superior Court looked at, I believe it's Jones versus Elliott, and said that it's a derivative claim when you think about the substantive elements of it. For example, have you filed within the statute of limitations? It does assumption of risk apply. However, the existence of the claim is separate from that. And there, I think in Jones v. Elliott, the ruling was a release by a spouse of their claim didn't knock out the loss of consortium claim by their spouse because they weren't specifically referenced there. So when we talk about
But I'm talking about wrongful death. I'm not talking about loss of consortium.
Well, I think the analysis would be the same to both of them. They're both.
Why? Because consortium's common law and the Wrongful Death Act is statutory, and it defines a wrongful act. And it makes it clear that it's derivative.
It does, although I think the common law claim for loss of consortium has also been interpreted with that same derivative idea to it. That's in Jones v. Elliott. So when we interpret the statute, that's how the word derivative would be interpreted. Is,
well, the word derivative doesn't appear in the statute, but a definition of wrongful act does. So there's not much room for flexibility for a common law court when the wrongful death statute's in derogation of the common law and the legislature says, in so many words that one could argue is very clear and unambiguous, that it's derivative.
That's true, but derivative doesn't necessarily mean that a later contract would necessarily apply. I think when you're interpreting, you know, does a particular release apply across to the spouse, that's not the same meaning as derivative. Derivative goes to proving the elements of the substantive claim as opposed to contract applies.
You're talking about a release. Is there a difference between a release and a contract where you waive claims?
I think there is. I think there's a difference between...
Well, what is this? And did the trial judge decide that the contractual language was a waiver of claims beyond insurance or was a release of claims that could have otherwise been made under the law of either Dubai or Delaware?
I think that's part of what the Superior Court made an error on, which is it viewed it as a general release, which releases past claims as opposed to an exculpatory clause, which is how the defendants are trying to rule on it here. And so the trial court ruled that by signing to this, the decedents had waived their claim, even their future claims with it, but then decided that contractual waiver doesn't apply to the spouse's claims.
You're in your rebuttal time. Did you want to save it?
Yes, I do, Your Honor.
I think we should take more time.
May it please the Court, Robert Wallace for the appellee. Your Honor, as is pointed out, these are unique circumstances, and this is a unique case. We have a situation where employees are performing services that were otherwise done by the U.S. military in places like Afghanistan and Iraq, and this is in Afghanistan. And you have an employer attempting to manage the risk that it faces by operating in a war zone and attempting to perform tasks that are necessarily going to be complicated by the fog of war. With respect to the plaintiffs, I don't think there's any question that Afghanistan then and now was a very dangerous place, that IED explosions occurred in Afghanistan and occurred in those type of areas where the defendants operated and where the employees sought to go. And if you only need to look to their employment contracts, where one of the provisions of their compensation is hazardous duty pay, and the hazardous duty pay is defined by the State Department of those situations of dangerous conditions where you are entitled to an additional 25% of your income because you're involved in a situation which is either a war zone or a war-like territory. So I don't think there's much question that the plaintiffs knew they were going into a dangerous place. If you look at their agreement, it talks about death, injury, disability, and it also seeks, as part of the quid pro quo for the risk shifting, to accept a life insurance policy that for which they receive payment of $160,000, and to accept disability benefits. To accept life insurance and to accept disability benefits and to talk about danger and to talk about injury and to talk about death certainly seems to indicate that somebody is aware that something bad is going to happen to them or could happen to them if they go to a place like Afghanistan.
All that said, isn't the issue here not the inherent dangers of being in a war zone, but whether or not this contract defines the relationship between employer and employee in the sense of being protected from the employer's negligence?
I think that
you can be in danger in a war zone and hopefully not in danger by the negligence of your own employer while there. And while I can understand contractual relationships similar to the military and the U.S. government contracting for people rather than permanent employees with pensions and medical benefits like our military, contracting this out to civilians, the issue here isn't war zone and dangers from war zones. The issue here is what does this contract say and what does the law say in the appropriate jurisdiction about protection of employees from the negligence of their own employer?
Fair, Your Honor. The release and the assumption of the risk analysis of the Superior Court said that inherent in the fog of war and the nature of hostilities is going to be a number of conditions that could occur. And when you assume the risk for the mission and the dangers of the mission, you assume that it can be less than pretty.
The point here is, let's apply Delaware law for a moment. Delaware law seems to say in two or more cases that when a party to a contract wishes to be exculpated from their own negligence, they have to state that explicitly in the contract. In this contractual language, the word negligence of the employer doesn't appear. The references are to any claims for injury, death, or disability, if I remember the phraseology correctly. Now, if Delaware law applies, is there something missing from this contract that was required in order to exculpate the employer from liability for its own negligence?
I think not, Your Honor.
Okay.
And that is because I think that it is the danger inherent in the mission that is being assumed in the primary assumption of the risk by the employees. They are saying,
was the trial judge confronted with undisputed facts that were material to that issue, like whose negligence may have caused this death and injury, where did that negligent act occur, what were the circumstances surrounding it, was it indeed as suggested by the briefs, the deceased and injured employees asking the employer in light of intel to take security precautions that the employer refused to take. Now, when you tell me that somebody's in a war zone and they're subject to inherent dangers of being in a war zone, I get it. I've got a daughter and son-in-law who've been in Afghanistan. I'm an Army guy myself. I get all that. But to me, there's a different issue in a factual circumstance when the employer is told we need to take extra security precautions and the employer says no. Did these employees walk into a situation so inherent and fraught with danger that it would include the failure of their own employer to act as a reasonably prudent entity or individual? That's my question.
Your Honor, I think when the employee assumes the risks inherent in the mission and talks about the dangers of the mission And
so you're telling me that inherent in the danger of the mission is the negligence of their employer?
Well, if there were an enemy attack, for instance, and let's say there was an enemy attack on Dine House, and the allegation is that one of the sentries should have been posted or should have done a better job or should have sounded the alarm earlier, that would be included in this assumption of the risk and in this release, even though war is not perfect and not always are you going to have a situation where you're going to be able to stop an enemy attack.
Well, but and the analogy here isn't that the sentry didn't give timely notice. The analogy here is more like leaving the front door wide open and unlocked so someone could drive a truck through it. And someone calls up and said, you know, that's not really a good situation. We ought to close the doors so no one can drive into the compound. And the employer says, no, we're going to leave the doors wide open. Would that risk have been assumed?
If a risk is so substantial and is so wanton as to be void for public policy, then you could void such an agreement on those grounds. But that is not the facts that you have here, Your Honor.
No, I understand that, and that wasn't the purpose of my question. And the purpose of my question is, how do we know what risks were assumed as a matter of law? As I asked your opponent, it seems the Superior Court concluded, once you go into the war zone, you assume all risks, including those that are attributable to your employer because you're in a war zone. And the argument is, well, no, we assume the risks of war, but not necessarily our employer's negligence. How could that be determined as a matter of law at this stage of the proceedings?
Well, the court had before it the allegations in the complaint. And the allegations in the complaint do have some general language about willful misconduct, but the factual predicate for that argument by the plaintiffs is that they gave warning of an impending attack, and they wanted to block off the road. Now, the issue of blocking off the road or how to block off the road is not a matter that came up on a motion to dismiss before the court. I know what happened, and I can tell the court, but the question really is, what did the trial court have below? I mean, we have an affidavit from the State Department that said we couldn't block the road if we wanted to, but that was not what you consider on a motion to dismiss. So we think that when you talk about the inherent dangers in the mission, you have to take into account that there are going to be, in a situation like that, there are going to be mistakes and there are going to be issues that are going to occur. It's not as if I agree to release you or I agree to assume all responsibilities for the risk so long as nothing bad happens that could in any way be attributable to somebody other than me or the bad guys. That would not be much of a release.
Well, that's the purpose of my question, because if the Superior Court was correct and you assumed all risks, even those attributable to the employer, then you could rule as a matter of law. But if we go back to your answer, which includes things that aren't in the record, then you really don't dismiss at this procedural posture, but they would come in and say, we didn't assume the risk of your negligence, including your inability to close the road. You would come back and say, well, we didn't have the right to close the road, even if we thought that was a good idea. And then the case might have been dismissed at that stage. What we're struggling with here is, why was the case properly dismissed at this stage of the proceeding and based on what the Superior Court had? And the only answer can be, is they assumed the risk of everything.
Related to the mission. They wouldn't assume the risk that they would get food poisoning or that they may fall down a stair that wasn't properly maintained by DynCorp. It's related to the dangers of the mission. It's the focus is on the mission and mission dangers, not just from the moment I leave the United States to the moment I come back.
So there are risks out there that this exculpatory clause would not have covered, even though it says any claims?
It would cover any claims related to the mission.
And being on a premises where there was a broken stair that caused an injury is not related to the mission?
Well, I would say you could make a better argument that if you had a premises issue that was no way related to security, enemy, or attacks, or issues like that, you may have a different situation than you have here. But here we have an IED attack, which is clearly contemplated in the mission. We have an enemy attacking.
Well, your answer suggests to me that any sense I had that this contractual relationship was an attempt to create a legal relationship analogous to a soldier and the Defense Department or the United States government or workers' comp and an employer would be wrong, because there are, in fact, claims out there that for which the employer is not exculpated.
Well, Your Honor, I said it would be a different case. I didn't mean to say they wouldn't be exculpated. I think what you pointed out earlier, Your Honor, when you said it is like a workers' comp situation, is precisely what we have. FZ, who signed the agreement, they have a Defense Base Act relationship with these employees. They haven't been sued, and the reason they haven't been sued is because it is Defense Base Act.
Is it fair to say that the trial judge didn't consider a number of legal issues when he resolved this case on the basis of assumption of the risk? By way of example, what does the underlying contractual language mean? Is it clear and unambiguous? What are its implications? The law of what jurisdiction applies? Where did the negligence actually occur, and does that have a bearing on choice of law? Is there a distinction between choice of law for interpreting the contractual terms and a distinction for the lex loci in the case of a negligence claim? What's the meaning of the definition section of the wrongful death statute? Is there a distinction between consortium as a derivative claim and wrongful death is or is not a derivative claim? Did he address any or all of those issues?
He addressed most of those issues, Your Honor, because between the Parlin case and the Dooley case, he dealt rather extensively with the whole application of foreign law.
Did he come to a consistent result in those two cases? Can you reconcile the two logically?
Yes.
Tell me how.
I believe that in the Parlin case, he came to the conclusion that the release covered all of the claims for the parties who signed the releases and did not cover the claims of those who were not parties to the releases. That in the Dooley case, he concluded the same and said, but there is primary assumption of the risk here. And because we have primary assumption of the risk, a matter that was briefed in Dooley and not in Parlin.
Okay.
That's the only reason.
That application is that Delaware law applies. And what's the basis for that conclusion?
Judge Silverman concluded that in doing his choice of law analysis, that Delaware law applied because the law of Dubai and the law of Delaware were essentially the same.
There's assumption of the risk in the law of Dubai?
A assumption of the risk is akin to eliminating a tort. And there is the law in Dubai that says matters such as force majeure are not torts. Matters, injuries caused by another where you are not directly involved is not a tort. So we have a force majeure situation here, which is akin to taking away the tort altogether, eliminating it and not getting into the release at all.
But that's different than assumption of the risk, isn't it?
It's a different concept, but it has a similar result. It eliminates the tort.
Well, should the analysis be under Dubai law or Delaware law?
Well, the Dubai law would control the contract, and the parties agreed to that. The question is whether there's a substantial difference between the two jurisdictions, between Dubai and Delaware. Dubai would allow for this type of release, although as long as it's a limiting exchange for, and if one, as my opponents suggested, one were to go back for more, they would have to go back against FZ, which is not a party in this litigation.
What is the source of legal duty for the defendants in favor of the plaintiffs?
The source of legal duty of the defendants in the case of a primary assumption of risk is that the plaintiffs take over the duty in exchange for a bargain. And they bargained for the life insurance policies. They also received hazardous duty pay and other considerations. And that was their bargain. I will take over the duty. I will take over the responsibility for the tort in exchange for the compensation that I'm receiving. And that's so the duty's eliminated.
Your alternative argument was that there's no liability in this case. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And the Superior Court did not address that?
Well, they addressed the fact that there was assumption of the risk, thereby eliminating the duty, and thereby, even if we were negligent, we're not liable. I don't know if I'm being responsive or not. I hope I am.
I suspect you can't respond any more clearly than that, because that is what the trial judge said, and our inquiry is, did he go to step two without addressing step one, and do we have to address step one in the absence of him addressing it? And that's not typically what we do.
Yes, Your Honor, I understand. I think that the language, we think the language is clear. We think the plaintiffs assume the risk that they bargained for and agreed upon all of the risks related to the mission. And there's no question in our mind, and nor was there in the trial court's mind, obviously, that the risk inherent in the mission is an attack, an IED attack, just as it would be an enemy attack or a mortar attack or any other type of attack.
Even if there could have been a step taken by the employer that would have prevented the attack, but the employer's decision not to take that step may proximately have resulted in the attack and the damages that flowed from it.
Yes, because when you're talking about the fog of war, you're talking about a war zone, you're talking about the risks that are inherent in the mission, you can always come back and say, but for this or but for that, it wouldn't have happened or it couldn't have happened. And I think that if you go down that road by applying sort of some of the language that's used in general release cases that don't have this kind of unique situation, then I think you're really applying the wrong standard. That when you're in a war zone, you have to assume things can happen and it can be a lot of people's fault. And that's what they're doing by assuming the risk, and I think that's what the trial judge found and properly found.
Okay. Any other questions? Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Aaron.
Before you start, does the record reflect why the immediate employer is not in this case?
The record doesn't reflect it, but I can describe it if Your Honor wishes, which is opposing counsel is partly correct in that the immediate employer is immune from liability under federal law, but federal law specifically exempts everyone else from that immunity. So general contractors to the mission, regardless of the relationship to the employer, are still entirely liable under the Defense Base Act as interpreted by the Supreme Court. To answer a handful of the questions, there was a bit of discussion from opposing counsel about the merits under Dubai law.
Well, you just made a reference. So the basis for your claim is a federal statute?
Oh, no, Your Honor. There is a federal statute which provides immunity from tort for employers working specifically under government contracts abroad if they purchase certain insurance. That immunity, however, explicitly does not apply to any parties other than the specific employer itself. And here the specific employer itself was essentially a tax shelter in Dubai, as opposed to defendants, which were the actual entity controlling the situation in Afghanistan. The opposing counsel raised a couple factual issues about Dubai law and if there's an assumption of risk doctrine there. I think it bears mention here that defendants' experts didn't talk about the facts of this case at all. Their reports are entirely on the Parlin case, and so I don't think there's any record here whatsoever. And the trial court didn't look to that. Instead, it, and I believe this is on page 11, it assumed for its analysis that defendants' negligence and recklessness had caused the harm at issue here.
What is your position? What tort law applies?
Well, that's part of the problem. If we don't know the facts here, if we don't know where these people were when they made these decisions. So our default position, based on the limited information we know, is it's a Delaware corporation. It consented to the laws of the state of Delaware. Delaware substantive law can govern its conduct because the state of Delaware has an interest.
What supports your assertion that the decision was made by these entities that you've sued? Let's suppose the facts are that the immediate employer made all of these decisions on the ground in Afghanistan, and that was it.
We know that factually isn't correct. We have plaintiff Joe Dickinson knows who he was talking to about these situations, and he knows who they are employed by. And those contracts, if you notice at the end, specifically describe which entity could be the employer. Plaintiffs know that the employer in this case was, in fact, the defendants for the other individuals involved in the supervisory capacities. And it was the individuals on the ground, like the plaintiffs, specifically, who were employed by the FZ entity that's not a party here.
And that's all alleged in the complaint?
I believe so, Your Honor. I haven't looked at that specifically, but I'm fairly sure it is.
Well, that's fairly important to withstand a motion to dismiss, isn't it?
Well, it's alleged in the complaint is that these are all of the defendant's agents. And I think it's important to point out here that in the Parlin case, which has the same type of agreement, the defendants tried initially to raise a borrowed employee defense and to say, look, you know, these were all acting on behalf of that employer, and so they're all also immune under the Defense Base Act. I requested discovery on that. They objected, court ordered it, and then they waived the borrowed employee defense. So I think when the facts come out here, I don't really have a doubt that defendants will be the ones who employed the individuals who committed the tortious acts here.
Counsel, thank you very much for a very intriguing argument. I heard the reference to fog of war. I'm not so sure that I'm not walking out in the fog of law. We'll be in recess and take the case under advisement.